The name of the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This series is called Favorite Poets. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is W.S. Merwin, who won the Pulitzer Prize for The Carrier of Ladders. He is a special consultant to the Library of Congress and to the Poet Laureate of the United States. As we reach this millennium, Mr. Merwin is here to help with his advice. I have some 10 books on the table from which he will read, and we will hear an opening poem from Travels.
There's a poem called The Blind Seer of Ambone. And the blind seer was a man named Georg Edward Rumpf, who was a German, who went to the Dutch East Indies, was kidnapped, actually, and taken out there, and spent the rest of his life there. He was a contemporary of Ben Jonson and Shakespeare. He wrote the first encyclopedia of the Indies and the first flora of the Indies and lost his wife and his daughter and finally, on both books and the sight of his eyes, rewrote both books. He wrote them first in Latin and then in second time in Dutch and illustrated them. And they've survived. They're extraordinary books. And he became blind in the end of his life. And the island he lived on was Ambon. So the title of the poem is The Blind Seer of Ambon. I always knew that I came from another language. And now when I can no longer see, I continue to arrive at words. But the leaves and the shells were already here. And my fingers finding them echo the untold light and depth. I was betrayed into my true calling and denied in my advancement. I may have seemed somewhat strange, caring in my own time for living things with no value that we know. Languages wash over them one wave at a time. When the houses fell in the earthquake, I lost my wife and my daughter. It all roared and stood still, falling where they were in the daylight. I named for my wife a flower as though I could name a flower, my wife dark and luminous and not there. I lost the drawings of the flowers in fire. I lost the studies of the flowers, my first 6 books in the sea. Then I saw that the flowers themselves were gone. They were indeed gone. I saw that my wife was gone, and I saw that my daughter was gone. Afterward, my eyes themselves were gone. One day I was looking at infinite small creatures on the bright sand, and the next day is this hearing after music. So this is the way I see now. I take a shell in my hand, new to itself and to me. I feel the thinness, the warmth, and the cold. I listen to the water, which is the story welling up. I remember the colors and their lives. Everything takes me by surprise. It is all awake in the darkness.
The voice of W.S. Merwin. Mr. Merwin has been at the library as a visitor before. He is the author of the collections The Carrier of Ladders, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize, The Compass Flower, The Rain in the Trees, The Vixen, Flower and Hand, The River Sound. His translations include selected translations for which he won the Penn Translation Prize. His selected poems have won an award. His vertical poetry is a collection of poems by Juarez. I'd be up very late tonight if I read the title of all of your translations, all of your plays, and all of your books. But we will be able to mention many of them today. Will we be hearing another poem from Travels? I do know this book. I understand that there are different persona throughout the book. You gave us a sample of one.
Yes. There are many of them that are about other lives and other travels. The last ones are short poems that are about travels of my own. And this is one of them, called On the Old Way. After 12 years and a death, returning in August to see the end of summer, French skies and stacked roofs, the same grays, silent train sliding south through the veiled morning. Once more the stuccoed walls, the sore pavilions of the suburbs, glimpses of rivers known from other summers, leaves still green, with chestnuts forming for their only fall out of old dark branches. And again the nude hills come back, and the sleepless night travels along through the day as it once did over and over. For this was the way, almost home, almost certain that it was there, almost believing that it could be everything in spite of everything.
That is a very celebrated poem and much admired. Is that the first time it was published, that
yes.
poem?
I think it was in the New Yorker before that.
That's
yes.
right. I have here a stack of books which would scare any other man away, but you're undaunted. And the top one I've chosen is called Flower in Hand because it's a new book. And it takes into account three previous books. Flower in Hand has poetry from The Compass Flower, that was 77, Feathers from the Hill, 81, and Opening the Hand, 83. I like very much the combination of titles then, Flower and Hand. Did you have something to do with that?
Well, we put together The Compass Flower and Opening the Hand.
And this is Copper Canyon Press, who should get all kind of kudos.
Oh, they're wonderful.
Oh, they're terrific, aren't they? I have chosen two poems just to give you a taste of this. And the first one is The Heart. You have to be a pretty good sport to be handed a book without warning.
The Heart is, the introductory poem to The Compass Flower. And because it's a compass, it has four directions and four parts, and so does the heart. In the first chamber of the heart, all the gloves are hanging but two. The hands are bare as they come through the door. The bell rope is moving without them. They move forward cupped as though holding water. There is a bird bathing in their palms. In this chamber there is no color. In the second chamber of the heart, all the blindfolds are hanging but one. The eyes are open as they come in. They see the bell rope moving without hands. They see the bathing bird being carried forward through the colored chamber. In the third chamber of the heart, all the sounds are hanging but one. The ears hear nothing as they come through the door. The bell rope is moving like a breath without hands. A bird is being carried forward, bathing, in total silence. In the last chamber of the heart, all the words are hanging, but one. The blood is naked as it steps through the door, with its eyes open and a bathing bird in its hands, and with its bare feet on the sill, moving as though on water, to the one stroke of the bell. Someone is ringing without hands.
Mm. We are at the Library of Congress with W.S. Merwin. I have chosen Twilight also.
Oh, you are never tame, fire on a mountain, eyes beside water, first day of petals, lying across the bed in afternoon rain light, arms of evening, wherever we are as ashore.
W.S. Merwin has been awarded the Tanning Prize, the Pulitzer, and Bollingen Prizes, the Fellowship of the Academy of American Poets, the Shelley Memorial Award, the Penn Translation Prize, and many other honors. Is there a prize you haven't gotten?
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, well, let's get it.
Don't think about that.
Oh, you can. W.S. Merwin, I chose these poems because he is our most celebrated poet in America, with his life a testimony to the spiritual identity of the poet. And he is famous. If one can be famous for confronting their mortality, you have over your life's work chosen to be a voice before you were born, while you're here, and speak as if you have already gone. It is an eternal voice, and I think that you will be known for that. Much will be written about that. We're very honored to have him, and we're plowing through, actually. We have the three books, which were compiled into Flower in Hand, so I thought it might be nice to have a taste of each. And I love The Dreamers. Do you like that?
We're going backwards, aren't we? Yes, sure.
We are, in time.
I don't have opinions about my poems, I mean, mostly, but there they are. Once I've let them go, as the cat lets her kittens go, you know, I mean, they don't belong to me anymore. Yeah, why not start with the first one, which was the breakthrough poem when all of the new poems began.
What is the title?
Home for Thanksgiving.
Oh.
I was thinking of an old sourdough that I saw on the streets of Montreal when I was 19 years old, and that's what I was thinking about. And so it's in his voice.
Now, I looked at that and I said, he's not going to want to read that.
Well, some people have thought it was autobiographical, but it certainly is not. No, there are things in the poem that I would never have said myself, about myself. But it has a kind of relation to the poems and travels in that it's in the voice of somebody talking about their lives. And this was long before travels. This was when I was 30 that I wrote this poem, called Home for Thanksgiving. I bring myself back from the streets that open like long, silent laughs, and the others spilled into in the way of rivers breaking up, littered with words, crossed by cats and that sort of thing. From the knowing wires and the aimed windows. Well, this is nice on the third floor and back of the billboard, which says now improved, and I know what they mean. I thread my way in and I sew myself in like money. Well, this is nice with my shoes moored by the bed and the lights around the billboard ticking on and off like a beacon. I have brought myself back like many another crusty, unbarbered vessel launched with a bottle from the bare regions of pure hope, where for a great part of the year it scarcely sets at all, and from the night skies regularly filled with the old movies of my fingers, weightless as shadows, groping in the sluices, and from the visions of veins like arteries, and from the months of plying between can and can, vacant as a pint in the morning, while my sex grew into the only tree, a joyless evergreen, and the winds played hell with it at night, coming, as they did, over at least 1,000 miles of emptiness, thumping as though there were nothing but doors, insisting, come out, and of course I would have frozen. Sunday, a fine day, with my ears wiped and my collar buttoned, I went for a jaunt all the way out and back on a streetcar, and under my hat with the dent settled in the right place, I was thinking maybe, a thought which I have noticed many times like a bold rat, I should have stayed making some of those good women happy for a while at least, Vera with the eau de cologne and the small fat dog named Joy, Gladys with her earrings cooking and watery arms, the one with the limp and the fancy sheets. Some of them are still there, I suppose. Oh, no. I bring myself back, avoiding in silence, like a ship in a bottle. I bring my bottle. Or there was thin pearl with the invisible hairnets. The wind would not have been right for them. They would have had their times, rugs, troubles. They would have wanted curtains, cleanings, answers. They would have produced families, their own and our own. Hen friends and other considerations. My fingers sifting the dark would have turned up other poverties. I bring myself back like a mother cat transferring her only kitten, telling myself secrets through my mustache. They would have wanted to drink ship, sea, and all, or to break the bottle. Well, this is nice. Oh, misery, misery, misery. You fit me from head to foot like a good grade suit of longies, which I have worn for years and never want to take off. I did the right thing, after all.
The voice of W.S. Merwin. I am very glad you decided to read that poem, because one of the things you are well known for is taking the dailiness of life, the ordinary moments in life, and your book, Unframed Originals, is a very favorite of mine. I was thinking of that with the characters you evoke here. Those characters will never die. Those characters that you brought forth from your childhood, that prose work, it taught me how to write prose. It is the most unmanipulative, unmanipulative, the most genuine. I was astonished with that work. Although your prose is very much praised, Unframed Originals is, I think, much under-recognized.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. What I was doing was, of course, thinking about this strange childhood and this strange family and trying to get it onto paper so that I would remember it, so that I wouldn't lose it.
I'll never forget that limping uncle. I'll never forget the aunts. They're with me forever. I guess you can't say a better thing than that.
No, that's wonderful. Yes, it's what one would hope to do. But
why not read his awards? Why not? Kenyon Review Fellowship, Rockefeller Fellowship, National Institute of Arts and Letters Grant, Arts Council of Great Britain Playwriting, Rabinowitz Foundation, Bess Hocken Prize, Poetry Magazine, Ford Foundation, Chapel Brook Foundation, Harriet Monroe Memorial Prize in Poetry Magazine, Penn Translation Prize, the Pulitzer Prize, the Rockefeller Foundation Grant, Fellowship of the Academy of American Poets, the Guggenheim, the Shelley Memorial Award, Bullingen Prize for Poetry, Yale University Library, Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize, Tanning Prize, Academy of American Poets for Outstanding and Proven Mastery in Poetry. That's 1994. I just think, you know, we never take time to read them all because they take 5 minutes, you know, just the most recent ones. And I bet you couldn't even remember half of them.
Do you think people listen to the whole list?
They were probably walking through the kitchen as I read
so.
This. We're moving on.
I think
on.
I've been very lucky.
I think you've worked very hard. And a case in point is that there are several books that I hadn't even noted. The Folding Cliffs, I Do Not Know. And recent collections are Travels and River Sound. That was just 1999. The Vixen was mentioned. And there is yet one more.
Oh, it's the translation of Dante's Purgatorio, which is coming out in next April.
For which we will give an entire hour. At this point, we will move on. Let's see, did we hit upon this one, The Vineyard?
Oh.
I wanted this because we both knew Bill Matthews.
Yes. And this poem was dedicated to Bill.
It was early on. You must have been old friends.
We were old friends.
And he was a lovely, lovely man, wasn't
wonderful
he?
Wonderful man.
And beautiful.
He didn't get the recognition he deserved. He was beginning to get it just in the last years of his life. But Bill was one of the really most gifted poets of his generation, and there was nobody like him. He was completely his own man, his own poet. He was a very gentle and very witty man with many, many gifts. I mean, he was a great cook, and he loved music, and he was a wonderful friend. I mean, every one of his friends would tell you that.
I've never heard anything bad about him.
He knew an enormous amount about jazz. He was a great. He knew a great deal about all kinds of music. You never knew when you went to see Bill whether he'd have one of his jazz favorites or Haydn Quartet playing in the apartment. He was a wonderful, wonderful cook. And
he said, "Love is our work."
Yes.
That's Bill Matthews. Yes. And here's a poem dedicated to him, I think in 77.
Well, he loved wine. The poem is called The Vineyard. Going up through the hill called the Vineyard that seems nothing but stone, you come to a tangle of wild plum and hazel bushes, the spring in the cliff like the sex of a green woman, the taste of the water and of the stone. You come to the fox's cave in the yellow clay under the foot of the stone, and barely out of reach lime-crusted nests of swallows, and in the cliff higher up holes of swifts and bees, solitary grass. All that stone faces southward and a little to the east, full of crevices, bats and small birds, foxes and wild honey. Clear to the top they call it the vineyard, where earliest the light is seen that bids the cock crow.
The voice of W.S. Merwin, I am Grace Cavalieri. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and this series is called Favorite Poets. We are going back in time, and we've picked up another book. This is Writings to an Unfinished Accompaniment. And what is the poem that I have cited there?
The poem is called The Dreamers.
Do you like it?
Oh, you mustn't ask me whether I like poems of mine.
How long ago since you have read that?
many years.
That's why I thought it'd be fun. Yeah. It's a lovely poem.
This was written in Europe. In one of the dreams, men tell how they woke. A man who can't read turned pages until he came to one with his own story. It was air. And in the morning, he began learning letters, starting with A is for apple, which seems wrong. He says the first letter seems wrong. A man with his eyes shut swam upward through dark water and came to air. It was the horizon. He felt his way along it, and it opened and let the sun out. So much for the sun. And in the morning he began groping for the horizon like the hands of a clock, day and night. A man, nothing but bones, was singing, and one by one the notes opened and rose in the air and were air. And he was each one. Skin, mouth, ears, feeling, feathers. He keeps counting everything aloud, including himself. Whatever he counts, one is missing. I think I fell asleep on a doorstep. Inside, someone was coming, walking on white heads that were the best words I knew. And they woke at that step for the first time and were true. When I came to myself, it was morning. I was at the foot of the air in summer, and I had this name and my hand on a day of the world.
What a last line. What a last line. That's why I chose that poem. You have given dreaming a good name.
Oh, I think,
in your poetry.
I think dreaming began with a good name.
You've made it respectable in poetry.
Really?
It's one. Your poems are one long dream.
I think many poets have done that.
Of course they have. But I think consistently that you take us into another state. You do take us into another dimension. You do make the line from here to there very invisible in your work, and I think that's been said.
Well, I think it's much more visible than it really is. I think that the line is hardly visible in our lives around us, but we don't realize that we're walking in a dream most of the time.
As you point out in your work, translations have been an essential part of your career, as well as your contribution to American Letters. And as a young man out of Princeton, I think you made a living translating.
Yes.
And I have counted 20 books that I know of that you've translated. And I see in contemporary authors dozens more, but I do know of 20 by one count. And French, Spanish, Latin, Portuguese. Are you still pretty fluent? Can you still do those?
I can't do Latin anymore. I can read Portuguese more or less, but it's pretty rusty. French and Spanish, I'm pretty happy with, and a certain amount of Italian, and that's really about it. Everything else, I've relied heavily on scholars and native speakers, and I've always referred to them if I could.
As it is with this book I'm going to hold up here, if this were television, you would see it is a gorgeous book. It's called The Peacock's Egg, and it is Sanskrit, love poems from ancient India, 500 B.C. to 1,000 B.C., and they're pretty hot, too.
They're very hot poems. But those were done, as the jacket makes clear and the introduction, with Jeff Mason, J. Musayev Mason.
I was scared to say it.
Who has become much better known for other things since then.
What a gorgeous introduction, though.
He was in charge of the Freud archives for a while, and then he became a rather controversial figure. But he was a Sanskrit scholar to begin with.
One thing which I learned I had not known is that in Sanskrit poetry, there was never evidence of childhood dreams ever written about by the poet. And the poet would go back to former lives and make up fantasies about former lives to replace that which we all rely on, which is childhood memory. And I thought that was fascinating. And then I thought that I saw influences of The Peacock's Egg in a later book of yours. I'm sure everything must feed into the same river.
Everything influences everything.
I felt so personally involved to have read this and then to have read something which reverberates, you know. It was just a moment with you that no one else had. I thought I had discovered something. This is the book, I think, Opening the Hand was very influenced by The Peacock's Egg.
I don't know. It may have happened, but if it was, I certainly wasn't aware of it, but it probably did.
So I've chosen from one page to like another to give a taste of this Sanskrit poetry. Did you get it then in the ancient language and you flat literal English and you turned it into poetry?
That's right.
Is that it?
Yes. With Jeff checking them and making sure we weren't getting astray. And Jeff provided not only the original, but he provided a literal version and then copious notes about the literal phrase by phrase.
So, and there are great footnotes in there, too.
They are wonderful, yes.
So just a handful would be great.
Some of them are probably too erotic to read on the air.
I chose some that were not raunchy.
Yes.
So the FCC wouldn't get us.
That's right. But these are two little ones. And they're all quite short. Some of them, by the way, were written by monks and nuns, which is even more interesting. When hundreds of prayers at last had brought him back from long travels, and somehow the day had been got through, all his friends, fools, never thinking of the hundreds of longing wishes for him that had led her through the day, went on talking and talking until she jumped up saying, "Something bit me," and shaking the end of her sari, wanting him so much, blew out the lamp. Many of them are anonymous. This is modeled on the Kalidasa, which is a very famous Sanskrit poem. This is written by a blind poet of the 6th century named Kumaradasa. It's from a poem on the life of Rama. In their quarrel, she pretended to be asleep until he, shaking with passion, started to take off her dress. "Thief," she said, laughing, and boldly she bit his lower lip.
A lot of these characters wait for their husbands to go away.
Oh, they do. Yes.
Really? It's a precursor of modern literature.
I know.
The voice of W.S. Merwin, I am Grace Cavalieri. Program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and this series is called Favorite Poets. And so, as we have mentioned, Opening the Hand is another book by W.S. Merwin. And now let me see, I used to know what year this was. I think this was 83. And I've chosen two, and then one by about Berryman, because that is a gem.
Okay.
I would love that if you would.
The first one is
The Waters,
which is a poem about writing about one's past. I think one always writes about the past, you know, because language is made of the past. But The Waters. I was the whole summer remembering more than I knew, as though anything could stand still in the waters. There were lives that turned and appeared to wait, and I went toward them looking. Sounds carry in water, but not what I called so far. Sun and moon shone into the moving water, and after many days, joys and griefs I had not thought were mine, woke in this body's altering dream, knowing where they were. Faces that would never die returned toward our light through mortal waters.
Memory in sight. And the other was, I think, The Line of Trees. Is that the one I chose?
Mm-hmm. This is about a place in well, you don't need to know. It's called The Line of Trees. Along the west of the woods is a row of tall pines. The man who planted them came from an island thousands of miles to the south, and now with his wife, for a long time a nurse, but lately not right in the head, who came from an island thousands of miles from his. He lives down the road since their small house in the woods burned beyond repair, but he still comes by every so often to ignore the mailbox, rusted sedan full of vines, brown fruit in the grassy ruts. And when he is gone, a pheasant barks from hiding, bird of a far continent, and whenever the boughs part suddenly to reveal the yellow house wall with its window, what they show is a mirror full of western light.
I don't think there is a poet with as many diverse voices as you have had over the years. You can speak of the daily act, the ordinary. You can speak of memory. You can speak of a life beyond our knowing. You can speak of the natural world, and you honor that and are very well known as a champion of the natural world in your work. You have done so many different things. I don't think you dare to stop and think about it. It would be, you'd trip over your shoes if you stopped to think of all you've accomplished.
It would be terrible to start going back and thinking about what you've done.
Wouldn't it, though? It's more important
to think of what you haven't done.
For the sake of the audience, who actually, some of them may never have met you before, it's kind of nice to give a retrospective, and that's what we're doing here. Are we on Berryman?
We are.
Well, would you set that up and tell our audience who he was?
Well, John Berryman was one of the great poets of the generation before mine, and I think of Berryman, Lowell, Rethke, Elizabeth Bishop, Randall Jarrell as the great figures of that generation. They all died relatively young. I mean, none of them got past their 60s. And Berryman, of course, took his own life before he was 60 in Minnesota. His father had committed suicide before him when he was a child, and it had haunted him all his life. Alcohol had become a problem, and John was a tormented and incredibly brilliant man. His writings about Shakespeare had just been published, and he used to talk about Shakespeare brilliantly. John was a very difficult man, talked incredibly about poetry, and he was passionate about it. He was absolutely, ruthlessly passionate. And I would go when I was 19 every week and take him some poems, and he would tell me how terrible they were and destroy them one after the other. He cared about nobody's feelings. He felt that if your feelings were involved, the poetry was far more important than that. And he was ruthless to himself in the same way. I mean, a very, very beautiful essay about him by Phil Levine in a book called The Bread of Time about John as a teacher. Simply wonderful. And about John talking about that great poem, that sonnet of Edwin Arlington Robinson's about the god Apollo, which is about poetry and how nobody ever really measures up in the long run.
Hmm.
This poem is called Berryman, and of course, he became very well known as a poet. I knew him when I was very young as a teacher.
Was he at Princeton?
He was at Princeton, yeah. In a building which has since been torn down. And I should say that I also met Jimmy Merrill in Berryman's office when he came by Princeton. Jimmy was a year older than I. He was 20 and I was 19. So this was interesting. We were all there together. Berryman. I will tell you what he told me in the years just after the war, as we then called the Second World War. Don't lose your arrogance yet, he said. You can do that when you're older. Lose it too soon, and you may merely replace it with vanity. Just one time he suggested changing the usual order of the same words in a line of verse. Why point out a thing twice? He suggested I pray to the muse, get down on my knees and pray right there in the corner, and he said he meant it literally. It was in the days before the beard and the drink, but he was deep in tides of his own, through which he sailed, chin sideways and head tilted like a tacking sloop. He was far older than the dates allowed for, much older than I was. He was in his 30s. He snapped down his nose with an accent I think he had affected in England. As for publishing, he advised me to paper my wall with rejection slips. His lips and the bones of his long fingers trembled with the vehemence of his views about poetry. He said the great presence that permitted everything and transmitted it in poetry was passion. Passion was genius, and he praised movement and invention. I had hardly begun to read. I asked, how can you ever be sure that what you write is really any good at all? And he said, you can't. You can't. You can never be sure. You die without knowing whether anything you wrote was any good. If you have to be sure, don't write.
Am I watching you correcting the text in my books as you go along?
A couple of tiny typos.
Well, how will we ever know they're yours?
Well,
they could
you
be.
Won't.
I can't go to Sotheby's and they'll say, "Well, your husband did that." I'll say, "No, W.S. Merwin did that." Well, you can always tell a good story, and that's one thing I say about your diverse voices. An anecdote can make a fabulous poem, and that is a good anecdote about Berryman. And I bet he did say that.
Which did he say?
If you have to worry about it, don't write.
It's all true. I didn't make anything up.
I believe that. This is a book that I bet you and I have, and I don't know how many other people. It's kind of old, and it is a very interesting book that you should have fastened to, and yet I'm not surprised. They're aphorisms, right?
They're aphorisms.
And by an Argentinian.
Well, actually, he was born in Italy, Antonio Porcia, and went there as a... he was born in 1886. And he went to... His family took him to Buenos Aires in 1911. And he became Spanish, and he was a painter. And we don't know what else he was. I mean, because it not... I mean, Roberto Juarez, whom you mentioned earlier, was one of the people who knew him. He was a very, very retired man with no money ever. He held his clothes together with safety pins and things, and he did have some paintings that other painters had given him. But in the course of his life, he wrote 600 aphorisms, and I saw a few of them in a little tiny version in French years ago in the 60s, and was fascinated by them, and found out where they'd been published in Buenos Aires. So I got the original in Spanish.
Oh, so you discovered him in
a
way.
I discovered him in French, and then I wanted to find the original, and I got the original, found that the French translation wasn't very accurate. So I took to carrying the Spanish around in my pocket.
Hmm.
And I never thought of translating it, but I got curious. I mean, some of them got in my head, and I started translating them in the margin. Before long, I had quite a lot of them translated, but I didn't think of doing a book. And then I thought, well, I put them together and see what happened. And there have been a number of tiny editions of this. This is about a third. This book is called Voices.
Is that the Big Table series?
This is the Big Table.
Yeah, that was a... I don't think that exists anymore, that
no,
series.
No, it's out of print now, but...
But even if you read one page, they are luminescent thoughts and remarkable that you have preserved them. And so I think it's a contribution to share them.
The title is a translation of his title, which is Voces, and it's Voices in English. And this is a page almost at random out of the book. And it's six little aphorisms, and they're almost all one sentence or two sentences, no more. Truth has very few friends, and those few are suicides. Treat me as you should treat me, not as I should be treated. Man goes nowhere. Everything comes to men like the morning.
Mm.
He who holds me by a thread is not strong. The thread is strong. A little candor never leaves me. It is what protects me. A door opens to me. I go in and am faced with 100 closed doors. He's all like that. Here are a few more. This is another teeny page, a page I like even better. Only a few arrive at nothing because the way is long. I am in myself so little that what they do with me scarcely interests me. Certainties are arrived at only on foot. Man, when he realizes that he is an object of comedy, does not laugh. In my silence, only my voice is lacking.
I wonder if he appreciated the fact that you made him known even a little bit more than he was.
Well, I don't know, because... Whether he actually knew about the book, I never got to meet him. I wanted to meet him, and I never did. He was 82 when he died, so...
Oh, I didn't know that.
No.
And to live a life probably with no material rewards.
None.
None at all. I have just chosen that book, this book you're holding in your hand, which is Selected Translations, and that was from 48 to what year? 1948 to...
68.
68. Okay. First of all, because it's... They just don't make paper like that anymore.
No, they don't.
That is a real heavy book.
Well, this was a book that was put together by Harry Ford, who died in March. He was a wonderful designer of books as well as an impassioned editor of poetry, who put together one of the most remarkable lists of mid-century, which was the list that began at Athenaeum and then he took to Scribner's and eventually some of it to Knopf.
How did Athenaeum turn over the work to Copper Canyon? Nicely?
Well, what happened was that Copper Canyon has been reprinting the books that Athenaeum did, which was before I went to Knopf, before Harry and I both
right.
went to Knopf.
It's all very friendly, this interchange, because...
Oh, yes, because those were books before Knopf began publishing me. But.
Right, okay. To go back to Selected Translations, I had two questions about this book. First, who chose the poets?
Oh, I did.
Well... I have never, some of these poets, of course, I've never heard of, and they're from antiquity. But the first woman was in the 1900s, right? I mean, I'm not scolding the book, but I thought it'd be nice if we read her, because I'd never heard of her before.
Oh, yes. Well, she's a French poet, Anne-Marie Kegels. She is actually, if she's still alive,
yeah.
I think she is actually Flemish, Belgian.
So, to honor her, we will read that, if
yes,
it's okay.
Yes, she's a poet who's not very well known, but mm-hmm. I mean, these came out of reading from other languages, and just, if I liked a poem that seemed as though it might go into English, I would see what I could do. This is just a poem I found and liked. It's called Nocturnal Heart by, a Flemish-French woman named Anne-Marie Kegels, K-E-G-E-L-S. Nocturnal Heart. Master of blood, I am yours, O tireless captain, upright on the plains of sand. At night I hear you, march toward a doubtful sea, with footsteps falsely restrained. At that time I touch my breath, I search for you with my bare wrist, I defend you against the seaweed, the salt, the wakened fish. We faint under a wave. People tell of two that are drowned, of a fog mowing the beach. Midnight descends, covers my lips, keeps me from calling for help. We float, forgotten by day.
It is very nice to bring someone back from the dead. I don't mean that she's expired. I just mean that I'd never heard of her, and that you make this known through even books that are not recent. And that's very nice to resurrect someone who would not have life otherwise. Do you know, I marked Nietzsche because I had never read a poem by Nietzsche.
Oh, Nietzsche wrote some wonderful poems. I don't think you can understand the 20th century without coming to some kind of terms with Nietzsche, if we can ever understand the 20th century. One poem, small poem of his called mm-hmm. Against the Laws. And everyone knows who Friedrich Nietzsche was. I mean... The best-known book is Zarathustra, but my favorite book is The Genealogy of Morals, I think. And Against the Laws. Starting now, the hours of the clock will hang on a hair around my neck. Starting now, the stars will stop in their courses, sun, cock, crow, shadows, and everything that time proclaimed is now deaf and dumb and blind. For me, all nature is silenced, with the ticking of the law and its measure.
A much gentler
I don't know what
tone.
That poem means,
well, it's a much gentler tone than he's known for.
Well, he was a gentleman. You know, his last act before he became insane, his last act of sanity was to, when he saw a man beating a horse in the street. Nietzsche ran out of the door and flung his arms around the horse, between the man and the horse, to protect the horse. And then he fell down in the street.
And they said George Herbert did the same thing.
George Herbert?
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful.
I have Asian figures, and the reason I have that is because East Window is either out or coming out from Copper Canyon.
Yes, it's out.
And that is Asian translations. This is a very...
It includes this book, Asian Figures.
That is why I have... I would like the audience to hear a taste of this. And you have but one poem by a Laotian figure, and it is lovely. It is beautiful. So I would like you to read that. Did you choose these Asian figures?
I should say what the whole point of Asian Figures was. I was working with ideograms and with the ideogram way of writing, which is the Chinese, the way Chinese and Japanese are written. And I can't read ideograms, but I could read the kind of transliterations of each ideogram, and then try to figure it out. And in doing that, I was trying to see, working with tiny things like proverbs and odd fragments that came from these different, like riddles and things like that. It was an experiment kind of minimalism, trying to see what it was, how small you could get this unit that would be recognizably poetry. Because, you know, sometimes you don't know what separates poetry from prose, but you begin to recognize it. I thought, how small could this unit be when you would still say, yes, that's tiny, but you can see that it's poetry. And you mentioned George Herbert. George Herbert did a collection, which many people don't know, of proverbs. And some of those proverbs are very remarkable. They're quite clearly poems. I think very often proverbs and aphorisms and tiny things like riddles, if you look at them hard, they're poems. This was not a Laotian poem. This is a series of little tiny things that are even smaller than haiku.
Took fragments?
No, this is a series of them. There are six of these little teenies, you know. So it looks like six little stanzas of a poem. But they're separate ones, and they happen to fall into this order. Think of them as little proverbs or little tiny moments that show something. Says yes when nobody asked. Outside the ways of the old, the ghosts. When luck comes, keep your head. The more you want to own, the more you die. Close to death, you see how tender the grass is. High up, where nobody likes him.
It reminded me of that Italian form where you take one line from your great ancestors who were poets and make a poem out of it. Because that surely can be read as one poem also. Rather, of course, disparate. But like pearls on a string.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad we mentioned that. It is. I'm very glad. A lesser man would have fainted if anyone had handed him 10 of their old books. And we still have energy enough to look at this one. This is The Drunk in the Furnace, and I say 70s. Look, it was only $1.25.
$1.25.
At that time.
Published in 1960.
60, mm-hmm. I keep saying, and look, it's yellow. It's yellow with age.
Well, it would be. Mm-hmm.
But I like The Drunk in the Furnace. I think
That's
this
the
is the title poem.
It's the only time I ever had a title poem.
It's the only time you had a title poem in your book?
It's the only time that there was a poem, the title came from one of the poems. The Drunk in the Furnace. For a good decade, the furnace stood in the naked gully, fireless and vacant as any hat. Then, when it was no more to them than a hulking black fossil to erode unnoticed with the rest of the junk hill by the poisonous creek and rapidly to be added to their ignorance, they were afterwards astonished to confirm one morning a twist of smoke like a pale resurrection staggering out of its chewed hole, and to remark then other tokens that someone cozily bolted behind the eye-holed iron door of the drafty burner had there established his bad castle. Where he gets his spirits, it's a mystery. But the stuff keeps him musical. hammer and anviling with poker and bottle to his jugged bellowings, till the last groaning clang, as he collapses onto the rioting springs of a litter of car seats ranged on the grates, to sleep like an iron pig. In their tar paper church, on a text about stokeholes that are sated never, their reverend lingers. They nod and hate trespassers. When the furnace wakes, though, all afternoon their witless offspring flock like piped rats to its siren crescendo, and agape on the crumbling ridge, stand in a row and learn.
I chose that because your daddy was a preacher man.
Yes, he was.
He wasn't a drunk by any means.
His father was, though.
I thought how interesting it is to find the beginnings of your imaginings. And knowing the strict way you were brought up, humor me a moment. If you had chosen to come through your parents, why did you choose that mother and that father to become who you are? What qualities did they have that made you, that you took for your soul's journey, for your life's work?
My father loved language in his own way, and I grew up hearing the King James Version, although, I mean, I think many of his theological tenets were never very close to me. My mother was a very strong character and gentle and determined and a person of great, great probity and patience. And those are wonderful, wonderful qualities. And when they both died in the same year, and when my mother died very suddenly when I was away, so that she was, the funeral was all over by the time I knew about it, death. I went straight to the house and moved in and spent a month there giving things of theirs to their friends and eventually the furniture to my sister in the house. I sat there finally in the empty house.
Was it Scranton?
No, this was in western Pennsylvania, up north of Pittsburgh, near Indiana. But I remember that last morning sitting in that empty house alone before I drove away. And I sat there for a long time in the empty bedroom with just the sunlight on the floor. And it suddenly occurred to me that these were the right parents to have had.
W.S. Merwin, you who trust the dead and communicate so well with the dead, in honor of Mr. Porchia, we will send a sunbeam to him at the end of our program. Let us close with just a random aphorism.
You had your finger right under this one. It says, "Since I prepare only for what ought to happen to me, I am never ready for what does happen. Never."
The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. You have been listening to the voice of W.S. Merwin. This program has been brought to you by Forest Woods Media Productions. The series is called Favorite Poets, and it is a Library of Congress Bicentennial Project funded by the Madison Council. Our engineer was Brad McCoy. Post-production by Pam and Jim Smith of Muddy Hole Studios. I am Grace Cavalieri for The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.